The talk tonight is called Urge Surfing, Freedom with Desire. And so it's not called narrowing yourself into a tiny little postage stamp so that you don't do anything harmful or compulsive. It's not called hate your desire. it could be called be curious about your desire, be willing to notice your desire, be willing to really experience what desire is like when it happens. And all of that is a way of having a lot more freedom when we are in the mind state of desire. So the series on changing behavior in some way, it's a mindfulness approach, of course. And we recognize that generally speaking, unskillful behavior, compulsive behavior, all the way to addiction, is some kind of avoidance strategy. So, and usually what we're trying to avoid are difficult mind states. And so the behavior is some way to get out of the difficult mind state. And the problem is that the behavior has side effects. And so we sort of end up in double trouble. We have something we don't want to experience, and then we have a behavior to help us not do that, but then the behavior itself becomes something that somehow causes us suffering. And so it's double trouble. So, of course, with a mindfulness approach, mindfulness is the opposite of avoidance. And so the way we change our behavior is not by restricting ourselves and controlling ourselves and never feeling desire for whatever the behavior is. It's about turning towards the underlying thing we want to avoid, and also turning towards the desire, which is the thing that propels us. It's the momentum of the avoidance strategy. We want to avoid something, and so we end up getting in the habit of doing that in a certain way, whether it's through food or internet or, you know, TV or whatever our distraction is. And so desire becomes a thing that really continues the momentum. So I talked in the very first class about really, you know, being able to be with our difficult states. And the more we can do that, the less run we are by compulsive behavior. So, and mindfulness is the opposite of avoidance. It's turning towards all those states that we don't like to feel. Loneliness, boredom, hurt, fear, anxiety, anger, all of that, you know. There's lots of things we don't want to feel. Unworthy. So the first class, and you know, we've in this group, we've talked, I've talked a lot about working with difficult states. It's one of the fastest ways that we can start to feel the freedom of our practice. And then last week was really a focus on how we actually create our habits. So it was really a focus on karma, and kind of like the micro map of how we get in habitual behavior that's either unskillful or skillful. And so really the essence in terms of changing ourselves, the essence of understanding all of that, how we create our habits, is kind of, I call it practical karma. It's taking the woo-woo out of karma and just saying, actually, the karma is really habit. That's the biggest impact of our karmic actions, is the habits, the momentum we have in our mind for certain things. And so when we really understand karma, part away from all the woo-woo parts, we get that the only choice we have in life is how we respond to the moment we just woke up to. That is the only time And that is the only possibility of change. It's the only that's the only time we have choice in our lives. It's that simple. So if we're not aware of it, then it's just compulsive behavior. It's just automatic pilot. We're just doing whatever it is we do out of habit, and we don't even know we're doing it. So very famous quote from Viktor Frankl, Holocaust survivor. Between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space is our power to choose our response. In our response lies our growth and our freedom. So as I talked about last week, karma unfolds, our habits unfold out of our control into a present mind state. We don't control that, you know. We don't decide to get irritated or bored or scared. They happen to us out of habit, out of our mental habits. It's how we respond to that present result, that's our present action, that's when we have a choice. And that's what Viktor Frankl's talking about. And then those present actions are the karmic seeds for our future well-being or not. And again, let's not get woo-woo. It's just like you're just strengthening the habit. We're always practicing. You know, the question any meditation teacher will get sometimes is, well, how much should I practice? And it's like, well, you're always practicing. So it's not a question of how much to practice. It's a question of what do you want to practice? Because the mind is a creature of habit. And the more we repeat our mind, the more we're wiring the neural pathways along certain tendencies. So the mind greases its own skids. So we're always practicing. Everything we do is helping rewire our brain. So it's actually really important what we do with our minds. So our present responses to our experience is really creating our future habits. So we can take karma unfolds out of control from the past, and it will unfold into the future out of our control. But in the present moment, we can plant skillful seeds and really help our future a lot. So this is really key when we want to change behavior. So to change our behavior requires two things. It requires being aware, and it requires doing something about it now. The only time you can change yourself is now. So when you know, there's that quote, I think St. Augustine, Lord, make me pure, but not yet. Do you know that one? After I do this thing, then I'll, focus on change. But, that's a lost moment. If we've woken up to something, that the time to change is now. Seize the moment. Because it's not going to happen in 10 minutes. It's got to happen now. And so in terms of our habits, then, and in terms of habits that are born out of desire, the karmic lesson is that the more we gratify our desires, instead of lessening our desire, it increases them. It's the opposite of our common sense. Our common sense is we have a desire, so we do the thing, and then our desire goes away. Well, that's true. That little moment of desire is gone. But what you've done is strengthen the habit of desire and gratification. What mindfulness does with desire, one thing we can learn, which is really different, is that we can experience desire as a mind state and actually practice contentment. And it's a strange contentment, because the contentment is being with desire instead of acting out the behavior. But that deconditions the habit of desire. Acting out our desires and gratifying it strengthens the habit of desire. The famous Tibetan yogi, ancient yogi, Milarepa said, desires achieved increase thirst like salt water. Now, very important to not go into your life and give yourself a hard time for your desire. Because until you're fully enlightened, you know, desire is going to be with us. It's just part of the human condition. So again, this talk is not called get rid of your desire or control yourself so that you don't have desire. The talk is called urge surfing. Actually experiencing desire and being willing to as a kind of swelling of a wave in the mind that has movement and direction and then eventually dissipates by crashing on the beach. If we actually surf the desire without acting it out, desire is an impermanent mind state like every other mind state. So in this approach to change, we don't have to get rid of our desire. We have to outlast it. That's all we have to do. We have to outlast it with our mindfulness practice. And while we're surfing, be very curious about this kind of, you know, really energetic wave that's arisen in our mind stream that has a lot of momentum to it. So in the AA world, people talk about blackouts where you just, you have a binge where you go back to drinking and it's one drink and then like you didn't even know you were really drinking. You were completely unconscious of your behavior, until something happened that wakes you up, but maybe it was after the 9th or 10th drink. I mean, a friend of mine can't have one drink. He literally just can't do it. If he sits down and have one drink, he'll wake up like after the 10th drink to his behavior. He literally goes into a blackout. And this is what we all do with all of our kind of unskillful behaviors. We go into a kind of blackout, and what's pulled the curtain over the lights is desire. And desire is this extremely strong force in the mind. And yet, it's not. It's actually ephemeral, insubstantial, no big deal. Unpleasant, yes, but not such a big deal when we're actually conscious of it. It doesn't have to run us. So here's a story on desire from Joseph Goldstein. What happens when we don't let go? Asians have a very clever trap for catching monkeys. People hollow out a coconut, put something sweet in it, and make a hole at the bottom of the coconut, just big enough for the monkey to slide its open hand in, but not big enough for the monkey to withdraw its hand as a fist. They attach the coconut to the tree, and the monkey comes along and gets trapped. What keeps the monkey trapped? Only the force of desire, of clinging, of attachment. All the monkey has to do is let go of the sweet, open its hand, slip it out, and be free. But only a very rare monkey will do that. So, I've never seen that. And my brother-in-law is Sri Lankan, and I should ask him about that. Has anyone ever seen one of these? Just picture this poor monkey. Just it's so easy to be free, but that poor monkey is just not going to let go of this sweet. So we can really get this way with our desires. It isn't easy, but we actually can take the hand out with our mindfulness, with our awareness practice. So to do this, we first have to become conscious. Oh, there's behavior that actually I don't want to do anymore for whatever reason. And so one key piece is to have an intention to really get it that you want to change the behavior. And then to really set your intention first to be aware of the desire that drives the behavior. If your behavior is compulsive in some way, there's desire in it. And so our first intention can be to wake up to the desire in it and be willing to sit with it. And then the second intention can be to try the experiment next time you notice it of not acting it out, setting a boundary, refraining from the behavior so that you can turn inward and be completely free and open towards the mind state the behavior is coming from. So there's a tiny bit of control we exercise, and that's just in not doing the behavior. But that's just a boundary. Inside the boundary, we want to be extremely free, non-judgmental, and open, and just really allow whatever the mind state is. It might be desire, it might be disappointment, it might be frustration, or the even deeper emotions like loneliness, boredom, etc., unworthiness. A lot of compulsive behavior comes from unworthiness. So it's really, the idea is to not have a big restrictive sense of, oh my God, I'm not going to do that anymore, and make that solemn New Year's resolution, for the 30th year in a row, I will eat less this year, or whatever it is, that kind of willpower. Studies show that that kind of willpower doesn't work. What does tend to work better is little small steps in the direction that you want. And that's, again, that's change happening in the now. Where you actually are, you've got the intention to notice the behavior and notice the desire and the other mind states in it. Basically, like, what do you have to sit with to not do it? It's just the, simplest way to say it. And can you? Can you really be willing to just throb with the desire? And it's not pleasant, but it has only beneficial side effects. There is no hangover whatsoever. It's the opposite. It's just we feel better and better about ourselves. That's the side effect. So this is what's so important, is to really, really be loving and kind and open to the desire that's underneath the behavior and curious. And that cuts the self-judgment that can be the root of so many compulsive behaviors. And it's just reality-based. If you're sitting there giving yourself a hard time for desire, that's arguing with reality. Jack has already popped out of the box. You have woken up to the fact that you're in the state of desire. To beat yourself up is like trying to club Jack back into the box. It's like, that's not very nice to poor Jack. It's like, notice Jack. Notice what this is like. We can completely cut the self-judgment. We don't need a moment of self-judgment to change our behavior. And we have to allow our desire both as a way of refraining from the act as well as a way from really learning, like, what is really going on here? And, I know I've talked about this, but one of my tendencies that I feel like I'm doing a little too much these days is tuning into Barcelona soccer, and I mentioned that 3 or 4 classes ago. I love soccer, and these people are like the masters. They're just so good. And so, I really notice I'm doing it more than I would like to do it. It's getting in the way of other things that are important to me. And for me to not, go to a coffee shop where they show it, sometimes I really just have to sit with desire and disappointment and the desire fires, and then it fires again, and then it fires again, and it's throbbing. Literally, it can be throbbing. I mean, I can feel it like in my sort of back here behind my ears. I don't know why. And I feel inside of it this little voice that is like, we have to. we have to go now. What are you doing? You know? And in a mindful approach to substance abuse, relapse prevention, they have a thing called PIG, the problem of instant gratification. And these people, Alan Marlett, yeah, is one of the people who's, you know, doing this whole program on using mindfulness to prevent relapse into substance abuse. And one of the things they talk about is talk to the pig, the PIG, the problem of instant gratification, and really like picture it as this thing that just wants to more, 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 never satisfied, just desire, pure desire, and talk to it. What does the pig want, you know? The pig just wants, you know, for me, just hours and hours and hours and hours. It doesn't matter. Just watch soccer. you know you love it, you know? I mean, like, if I was to talk to the pig, that's what it would say. And there's just this there's this have-to language. So when you wake up to desire, somehow, somewhere in that desire is this sense of, I have to. And it could be the puniest little thing. It's like eating the Hershey's Kiss. You know, I have to have that. So the reason to turn to the desire is to see that that is the hook. That's where you get hooked and you don't even know it. But something inside of you, no matter how puny it is telling you, you have to do it. So really be on the lookout for that when you open to desire. The word addiction and dictator have the same root. Dictator, addiction. It's dictatorial behavior. The desire is owning us and not the other way around. And to sit with it isn't easy, but you can do it. And the more you do it, like the happier you'll be around the desire. Remember, desire is a impermanent mind state, and it will fire again and again and again if you really are sitting with strong desire, and then it loses its steam. It loses its steam. Again, you don't have to change it. You only have to outlast it. And that's not a tight little control-y thing. That's a big field of permission to let desire do whatever it wants. You know, or as someone said once on a meditation retreat, my first retreat, if you're fantasizing about your ice cream cone, leaving retreat to go get ice cream, just go for it. Let yourself really have it and enjoy it. Just don't leave the cushion. So that's kind of the idea, using mindfulness to change our behavior. So just a little desire poem. It's called Vessel by Patricia Campbell Carlson. Each day I'm a little crazier with missing you. The dog still snores on the couch, her paws dancing through a dream-lit field. The sun sets as usual, illuminating the red-frilled edges of newly emerging wild rose leaves. The veins on the backs of my hands run like ancient rivers toward the depths of the body. Why do I feel I need you so much more than these ordinary beauties? As if heaven slipped up and poured everything sacred into one single vessel, leaving me wildly aware of the way clay shatters. That's the way it is with desire. Everything gets, it's as if everything sacred got poured into one single thing. That Hershey's Kiss, or your lover, or this, or whatever it is, Barcelona soccer. And then I miss all the ordinary beauties, the dog with the paws dancing through the dreamlit field, the sunset with the red frilled edges of newly emerging wild rose leaves, the veins on the back of my own hands running like ancient rivers. We miss all of that. We're in the blackout of the compulsion, and we just miss that there's a lot of other things to be aware of. Okay, we're kind of halfway, so let me just open it up and see if there's any input, questions, comments, sharings.
So Peter, when you were talking about the monkey scenario, I really got a sense of compassion about my desire, because I thought, you know, that creature, that monkey, is so innocent.
Exactly.
You know? She just wants, you know, what they think that they need to survive.
Yes.
And it's not like there's some evil creature, you know?
Exactly.
And I got that. And I thought, gosh, if I could think of my own desires as these innocent creatures in some way, you know?
Exactly.
By a misleading idea of what it thinks I need.
Exactly. You
know? And so that's a lot softer of a attitude about it than, like, I've got to conquer this.
Exactly.
You know? So thanks for that example, because now I'm just going to imagine those desires as those, you know, little monkeys.
Caught monkeys. Yeah. Just wanting a sweet.
Yeah. So that's a lot. There's more compassion there.
Great. And I repeat things for the mic. The comment is that the analogy of the monkey getting caught is actually something that really helps you feel compassion for your desires, because really the desires are innocent. It's the desire. I mean, you could think of it this way: we're just programmed. You know, we are programmed with desire, and it's not like the desire's fault. It's the way we're wired. But we're also programmed to be able to wake up. And just remember, control and self-judgment are the two things that make us really anxious inside. And being really anxious inside is only going to lead to more compulsive behavior. So a control approach or a judging approach really backfires. We need to have care and compassion and forgiveness for our humanness, for all of our emotions that we want to run from, and to have even forgiveness and compassion to the wanting to run. You know, it's like also, if we don't know better, if we don't know we have a choice, we don't have a choice. So that monkey, in a way, doesn't know there's a choice. So that monkey doesn't have a choice. And that, you know, that's worthy of compassion. So if we don't know of some other way to deal with our loneliness and our boredom and our anxiety and our this or that, then of course we're going to choose compulsive behavior, because it does self-soothe us, you know, in the short term. So until we know an alternative, you know, we're going to do it. So we can have compassion.
Is the mindfulness part enough to try not to? So let's say your desire is to ruminate about something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are you trying not to just not talk, not think about it, in order to not give in to the desire to sort of control the discussion or whatever, try to fix that?
So if I hear the question right, is it do you allow the behavior, or do you just feel the desire, not allow the behavior? Is that the question?
Yeah, well, if the behavior is to ruminate about conquering.
Right.
Well, you
can really see a thought process as a behavior. And again, you know, our focus is on changing something that we feel, you know, is somehow unskillful or not helpful to us. And the motivation is not self-judgment or if only I improved, you know, then I could finally feel good about myself. That's not quite what I'm trying to encourage. I'm really encouraging something you see in you that you feel causes suffering for you. And so the motivation is compassion. So it can be, we can want to change a behavior like overeating or watching too much soccer, or you know, figuring things out or planning too much. I mean, so that could be one of the behaviors you want to change. And, you know, for the week, what I'm going to encourage you is a two-pronged approach. First, try not refraining from the behavior and really do the thing that you want to change and see how it is. Really see what it's like so that you can actually get real with yourself. Huh. Will that Hershey's kiss actually complete me? You know? Something in me says I have to have it, like I need that to be, you know, to be complete. If I'm really honest with myself, that's what I'm doing. It's like, really? Is that what's going to happen? Go ahead. Have the Hershey's kiss. See what happens. So that's one encouragement, is to act it out, but be really mindful of the experience. Does it live up to the hype? And then the second thing is to not grab the Hershey's kiss and then see what that's like. See how that is. So in your case, I would try both ways. But both times being really mindful. The first one you can learn about, like, the delusion that we often are in with our desires. And the second time we learn about not being run by the desire the second way. So, does that address what you...
When you make the realization that, okay, I need to leave now and go back and do what I'm not doing because I'm doing this instead, when you make that realization that you need to get up and go, do you feel complete that you get up and go? Do you feel like, oh, okay, I did what needed to be done not to continue this compulsive desire?
I mean, I'm just going to answer this very generally. The question is a lot about, like, I mean, I'm going to be kind of honest. I don't quite exactly know exactly. In my example, I was actually thinking of being at home or being in my office working and wanting to go. So, you know, that was a case where I didn't go because, you know, I was at the office. But if I'm doing the compulsive behavior, you know, generally what we want to do is we want to celebrate any time we change it, any time at all, even just once. You know, it all, our change all starts with baby steps. And we can only do it, you know, like in the now, in the small moment. So if you do it once, that is worthy of celebration. If you do it 12 times, great. You know, if you're abstinent for years, even better. Just, you know, keep celebrating. We don't need, you know. And the other thing to get around forgiveness of ourselves is that we're all always doing our best. Now, that might invite a lot of interesting thoughts in your head. When we are, like, shooting up smack, you know, like, just making ourselves homeless through a drug addiction, we're actually doing our best with what we know and what we got and who we are at that time in our lives. That seems like the best option. So, you know, we need to be really forgiving about how we change our behavior. It's more about, like, setting the intention and setting the direction and, you know, and getting a ton of support along the way. And giving yourself a lot of kudos for any positive steps in that direction. So, is that kind of more gen? I mean, I'm just answering you more generally.
Well, I guess I was thinking if you're out, so you're already out at the coffee shop and you're enjoying yourself.
Yeah.
And then you say, okay, but I'm going to leave at 11:15.
Yeah.
And then you look down and it's 11:30.
Blackout. Sure.
Desire.
Definitely.
Is that's something to be celebrated?
Yes. And celebrate yourself when you left at 11:30 because you didn't stay till 11:45. We need to be really forgiving. We're all so human, and substance abuse and addiction, now that's different. We're not talking about behavior at that level where addiction takes on its own dynamics, and where literally, again, my friend, he cannot drink one drink. He'll drink 10 or 15 before he wakes up. So for him, he needs to completely abstain the rest of his life. But he still has to do it one day at a time. But for behavior that's not like, at that level, that doesn't just have its own addiction dynamics, we can really go towards moderation and do it a lot less. I mean, I'm not going to stop watching Barcelona soccer. But, I do it too much, for given what my values really are. So I would like to cut back. But
you have to choose what to cut back from. I mean, which team to watch.
Well, yeah. So let's just kind of stop there and take a break. I don't think I could possibly say that again.
Just have to answer.
Could somebody repeat that? No, because I can't. What did I say? What's our topic today? Yes, to want is to lack. Thank you, Jean. So we will often feel desire as some kind of tension in the body. So in, these kind of compulsive behaviors, we really want to look to our body as the kind of bellwether. Because the body doesn't lie. The sensations are the least conditioned part of us. Sensations don't, decide to show or not show. Our feelings will, but sensations don't. So the more mindful you are of your body, the more you're going to notice what desire is actually like in the body. And because it's a lacking of something, we don't feel complete, that often shows up as tension. And the trick is to just allow the tension, relax into tension. We need to physically soften around the tension. Because the mental resistance to the desire is more tension, actually, in the body. So our trick is to turn to the desire, turn our back to the TV that's showing the Barcelona, turn on the mute button, turn your back to the TV, and feel the desire in the body. And it'll fire, and it'll fire, and it'll fire. And if you stay with it, it dissipates. And then it's amazing to see that it really is a wave that eventually crashes on the beach and just poof, gone. And that is the birth of freedom around your compulsion. And that is awesome. It's a great moment when you really watch the desire disappear just because you were the kind of steady shore of attention that the wave eventually just died on. Basically, that desire. And you're doing it in the moment. It's not like your desire is solved forever. But it's solved for that one. And when another one comes, you just repeat.
In about 2 seconds.
Well, that's what I mean. When you're mindful, it fires. It fires, it fires, it fires. Yeah. Just depends how strong the desire is. Now, also, this is not to pathologize desire. We can feel, oh, well, I meditate, and I guess I'm kind of sort of slightly Buddhist, I'm not supposed to ever get angry, and I'm not supposed to ever feel desire. Oh, you mean you're just supposed to not be a human being anymore. You're basically going to be Buddha the stone statue, as opposed to, Buddha the human being. Of course you're going to have desire. Of course you're going to get angry, unless you've just repressed it so bad that you never get angry. But so this is, you know, kindness is not about, like, giving yourself a hard time for the jack that popped out of the box, anger or desire. It's about getting curious about how you are and how's it working for you. So there's desire that works for you, and there's desire that doesn't. Find out what does work for you, you know, and what doesn't. Maybe the desire to take a walk, you know, with your sweetie and your dog works really well for you. Great. So very easy to meet desire with aversion. That's just more aversion. That's one of the three big troubles: desire, aversion, delusion. So you feel desire, and then you're like all hard on yourself, like, oh, what's my problem? That's just aversion. So when we sit with desire, one thing we will feel is that tension. You know, not always, but it can be there. So be on the lookout for that. Another thing we have to do is be with poignancy. So I want to read a quote from Mark Epstein in an article called In Defense of Desire. He's a Buddhist psychiatrist. He says, "We can treat desire the way we treat everything else in meditation. This means accepting it as it is, not pushing it away, and not holding on to it. In Eros, the Bittersweet, a big inspiration for my own book, the Canadian poet and classicist Anne Carson points out that desire implies the presence of three things: the lover, the beloved, and that which separates them. In other words, there's always a gap, an obstacle impeding the union desire seeks. This obstacle seems like a problem, and we want to get rid of it. This is clinging. I propose that if you relate to desire in a different way, if you learn how to simply dwell in the gap it opens up, then desire can become a teacher in its own right. In practical terms, this means learning to desire without expectations." That would be a trick. Desire without expectations. It means getting really real. And it means getting the gap. There's a gap. And there's something very poignant for us about humans. What we want, and tell me if I'm wrong, what we want is deep, complete, everlasting, unchanging happiness. Does anyone disagree? Okay. It's what we want. Most of us. That's what we want. And there's the Hafiz poem that's something along the lines of, "Beware of the counterfeit coins that buy you a few moments of pleasure and then leave you broken and dragging for days behind a farting camel." He's Persian. Ancient Persia, you know? The problem is not our desire. The problem is what we put our desire towards. And I heard someone say on the radio that, you know, we all worship on NPR recently. I don't even remember. It was a novelist. We're all going to worship something. So in England, it's royalty. We don't have royalty in the U.S., so we worship celebrities or sports, you know, Barcelona, soccer. We're going to worship something. So the key is, where are you going to put your worship towards? Is it going to be to the fleeting things, you know, the miles of aisles of tortilla chips, you know, like, I mean, how much nacho, you know, cilantro, lime, salsa, picante, like, I mean, how much can you squeeze out of a chip, you know? It has to be so extreme and so tantalizing, and it's just a freaking chip. So when our desires are directed that way, they just don't work very well. It's just a chip. Get, you know, like, let's get real. It's when we actually convert our regular desire into sacred desire, we see that our desire is not a problem. The problem is where we direct it. And if we direct it towards things that cause harm for us or others or are totally fleeting, it doesn't give us what we want, what we really want. What we really want is lasting, complete, deep, utter happiness. And so when your desire goes that direction, in Buddhism it's called chanda or zeal. It's sacred desire. It's when we're on fire with wanting freedom, wanting to get off the wheel of difficulty and samsara. And we really are on fire. That's like sacred desire that, you know, all of our desires ultimately, you know, some form of that. But we corrupt it by pointing it at the things that don't really work for us. So desire is not the problem. It's what we direct it towards. Does it serve you? So just take that into your life. Please don't beat yourself up for a moment of desire. Just get super curious and then notice when it serves you and when it doesn't. When does it really give you what you're really wanting, and when does it really get in the way? So, I think I've said enough. Anyone else at this point? You're gonna have to. I'm going to guide you in feeling desire experientially. So,
can you go over that again about the sacred desire and what that is?
Well, like in the Christian tradition, you know, we would say like desire for union with God. In the Buddhist world, we would say like desire for awakening, desire to be free from suffering. You know, to be off the wheel. And so it just depends on the tradition you're in. But it's really a desire for complete, true happiness. And it's just expressed differently in different traditions. And, you know, we could, one way to do this is just ask yourself, oh, the cilantro, lime, picante, blah, tortilla chip, what am I really wanting? Oh, well, actually, I want to be fed, you know. Oh, right, you know. And what'll that do? Oh, that'll help me sort of, you know, relax a little bit. Oh, and what'll that do for you? And you can sort of just keep going. And what you'll eventually get to is, I just want to always be happy. I want to never not be happy. And I don't know of anything that does that, you know, other than spirituality. Does anyone know? Of something that'll give you complete, everlasting happiness that isn't spiritual.
There's got to be a chip for that.
Or an app.
Can you talk about what Ann Carson was talking about, the gap?
Yes. The gap is the poignancy. I think, I mean, I'm interpreting it this way, and Mark might disagree, but I don't really care because I think this is my experience, that it's very poignant to see the difference between what our desire tells us is going to happen and what actually happens. There's a gap. We want, like, completion, but we want that completion to depend on getting this object or that object. But as one monk said, getting what you want is gratifying, but it isn't peaceful. It actually isn't deep enough happiness. It's kind of, you know, we get gratified, and then we're on to the next one, and then we got to get gratified again, and then we're on to the next one. It isn't peaceful.
Is, would you say the gap is something like longing?
No, the gap is the inability of these fleeting experiences like a chip to give us what we really want. But we have this idea that it will. Like if you really look at your desire, That's in the PIG. That's in there somewhere. Just do it. I mean, the compulsion, it's so strong. So I think that's the gap. Is, and I think that's maybe a little different than the way Mark Epstein meant it, but divine union, right? Non-separation, longing to belong. We want to belong to everything. And we're not going to be satisfied until we are. Until we're really awakened, there's a rub. So, and I think that's the gap. We need to sit with that. Okay, experiential time.